there are crimp connectors that will speed up the process of putting a connector on the end of a cable real fast. And if the connector is going to be used indoors, I would consider using a crimp connector if it wasn't a critical location, like the jumpers that are on a six-cavity duplexing filter for a repeater. There you want every connector to make 120 dB of shielding, and there are people who do heroic things to make sure that they're getting perfect contact on the connector, including even soldering the collet onto the braid before assembling the type N connector. They do things like that. But when it comes to an outdoor connector, I would never, never, never use a crimp connector. I don't trust them. Because the crimp, particularly on the outer braid, is crimping way back from the real interfacing forward portion of the connector. Therefore, there's an extra inductive length in there. The crimp is really a metal-to-metal contact, and if it builds up oxide, it's going to be making a poor contact. And on top of that, whenever the company I used to work for did a salt spray test, which artificially ages a connector, and they were doing this with SMA connectors, OSM connectors, some people call them, but the 3-millimeter connectors you put on the end of 141 semi-rigid cable. They did a crimp connector salt spray test, and a significant number of them were not making good contact at the end of the salt spray test. That would suggest that outdoors they're going to give you trouble. I'm willing to spend 15 or 20 minutes slowly, properly installing an old-fashioned UG21 Baker connector on the end of my cable. My philosophy is if I do a good job, it's going to be weatherproofed, and I'm going to use that connector outdoors for the next 20 years. And I own the connector instead of the connector own me. You take a quick and dirty job of putting a connector outdoors with a crimp operation, and if you didn't do a heroic thing to put shrink tubing with glue inside in order to weatherproof the darn thing, in my opinion, it's going to give you trouble within 1.5 years. And so you've saved 15 minutes of time by the rapid crimping, but the connector fails in 1.5 years, as opposed to spending the full 15 minutes installing the connector and you use it for the next 10 years. To me, one of those philosophies is false economy compared to the other. But that's me. And properly installed, my type N connectors, I'm very happy with them some significant number of years downrange when they're up on top of the tower. So that's my way of looking at it. Imagine some of you other guys have got some other opinions, and you probably want to express them right now. Give me your call letters, K2LAW in the TechNet.
K2J.
Eric recognized. Anyone else?
KC2MDP.
Good.
Okay, I heard BZH.
Okay, I heard EJ, MDP, BCH, and somebody who said good. Let's go to Eric first, KE2EJ. Go ahead, Eric.
W2VL, repeater.
All right. I can go both ways with this, but no, I agree with you. You know, nice, properly put together, soldered connectors, outdoors, like PL259. I would never, ever use a crimp version of that. But, believe it or not, most of your commercial installations of, you know, 7/8 inch cable, 1.5 inch, 1.25 inch cable, you can really have to kind of consider that they're really crimp connectors. And they last 20 years. But typically, on the indoor side of things, in a typical, you know, video installation, you may have about 4,000 or 5,000 BNC connectors that, in today's world, with digital signals running through them, it would take an awful long time to make those connectors if you had to solder each one. There's a company called King that makes really, truly excellent wide bandwidth BNC connectors to video. And a very interesting tool that it works with. Done properly, those, you can literally use those connectors and the cable hang things from and know that they won't fall apart. So, you know, the story goes both ways. If you go outside, one of the biggest mistakes that people make is they don't weatherproof their connectors. So, back to you.
And to HYR. HYR, also recognized. Yep. When it comes to indoor and things like video and BNC, I'm going to agree with you. But outdoor, crimp, and without heroic weather protection, I think it's potentially a problem. The next person on the list who signed in with connector info was Steve, KQMDP. You got it, Steve.
Yes, Dick. No, I agree with you 100%. Try and make the best mechanical connection that you can. Classic example, it doesn't have anything to do with RF, but I'm in the electrical industry, is outlets and switches with the stair block. You know, rather than wrap the wire around the terminal screw, it's got four little holes in the back, and basically it's just like a little spring clip that actually sort of like crimps into the wire. And I can't tell you how many houses we go into where there's a problem with those outlets because that connection just isn't mechanically tight enough. You know, down the line, you know, they'll lose power, and 99 out of 100 times it's got something to do with that crimp connector in that outlet. Back to you.
When it comes to the household wiring that you get involved with, Steve, is there very much aluminum wiring left in domestic houses? And if so, I'll bet it takes some pretty special care in order to create get rid of the intermittent grief. Back to you on that one, Steve.
You don't see too much of it anymore. I'd say probably, you know, houses, buildings, you know, in the mid-70s, I would say. You know, you come across there every so often, and they actually, the no locks you were talking about, you actually got to use that. And now, by code, you have to use these special wire nuts, and you have to actually, what they call a pigtail, a piece of copper onto the aluminum. Use the no locks, use the special wire nut, and then put the copper onto your switch, your outlet. Back to you.
And is that a special wire nut that is known to be compatible with both aluminum and copper?
Yes, it is. This is what they want you to use. It's not absolutely necessary so long as you use the Norlox or also called Paratrox, but this is what they want you to use. Yes, it is a special wire nut. It's a purple wire nut.
Okay, so if you do a good job, you're pigtailing the aluminum and the copper, you're putting the Paratrox or the Norlox on it, and you're using the purple type of wire nut, which is known to be compatible, and then you have a much higher chance of making a reliable contact with the aluminum. And I'll bet you in some cases the people who have enough knowledge of what's going on will insist on the wiring be replaced with real copper because the aluminum is too much of a problem for them. There have been a number of houses that have burned down because of aluminum. Okay, Jesse, I think, was the next person. N2HYR. I think you had a comment. Jesse, go ahead.
Yeah, okay. Yeah, I relate to our friend who mentioned the video connections. Yes, we use them by the thousands at work. Now with serial digital video and high definition video, it's 100% king crimp for indoor work for the video. And properly done, yes, you can hang from them. But for anything outside, anything with the steel trucks, anything subject to vibration, all that gets the special solder treatment and weatherproofing. Over.
Kind of glad to hear that.
Good evening.
Okay,
the
next person who signed in, thank you, Jesse, was Mr. BCH. Give me your full call letters and your name and proceed with your comments, sir. KQLAW, my name is Dick.
I just wanted to ask, you know, being that you're on the subject of connectors, I have some N connectors, both for RG8, RG58, and I got my hands on today at the Hamfest, as a matter of fact, some reverse polarity SMA. And what is a good resource to find out exactly how to prepare the cable ends for these? I know there's some in the handbook, but for the more obscure terminations, I need to find out exactly how to strip the cable. KC2BZH.
Pasternak catalog.
Okay, so the Pasternak catalog. Does anybody know any other? And by the way, is there a website for Pasternak? Yeah. That's right. Pasternak, I think, is a little small white catalog with a zillion connectors inside. And I think you're saying that the appropriate page tells you how to prepare the cable. Is that true?
You get detailed physical stuff with it, sufficient to guide you. Otherwise, they want to sell you their stuff at pirate prices.
Okay. What's the easiest way for a person to get the Pasternak catalog sent?
Probably off their website.
Okay, so if you go to Pasternak They've got a website, you give them an address, and they mail you a hard copy by snail mail. So that's one possible way to go. Mr. BCH, is that sort of what you're looking for?
Yeah, that's pretty much it. Like I said, you know, in most of the stuff that the general ham would have, you know, on hand, doesn't go into the more esoteric connectors, you know, that you'd use for like wireless networking, et cetera.
Alrighty. There was another person who signed in with reference to connectors and LMR cable. Who is that other person? Okay, maybe we picked them all up. Okay, I think we've covered that subject. Rich was the next person with a question. N2EO, go right ahead, Rich.
Okay, good evening, Dick, everybody on the TechNet, N2EO. Well, first off, I will make a comment on connectors. You know, I'm working 1296. I have a ICOM ID1, which is the new 12 GHz FM and DCO. Now, first of all, for the antenna, I'm using, and I'm a pretty big proponent of it because it hasn't degraded over the last few years. The cable comes from Germany. It's called Aircom Plus, being sold by Jerry Rodsky at SF Electronics. And his store deals in equipment. Cable connectors from 54 megahertz or 50 megahertz, I think he says, it's hard to believe, but 54 gigahertz. It comes in metric lengths. I think it's 100 meters or something. I forget, but it works out to about 82 feet. Well, you can buy it in multiples of 82 feet. And it's about the same cost as LMR 400. Uses a special connector, end connector, that he sells that comes from Germany because the cable is a metric. It looks a lot like RG8, but it's slightly different in diameter. It's a metric, and what I like about that connector, it goes on a little differently. There's a thimble that goes down between the center jacket and the braid. So when you tighten down the nut with the gasket, the cable does not compress. One of these end connectors, you put them outside, the cable compresses over a period of a year or two, and you can grab the end connector and twist it off. On these connectors, the nut that's holding the rubber gasket is pushing on the cable, and between the jacket and the inside diameter of the braid is this metal symbol. So it makes a very, very tight fit. I have not had any worse with this way. I don't have equipment to check it, but just checking signals, in the last 3 or 4 years that I've ran that stuff, I haven't seen any degradation on the stick. I'm quite pleased with it. What I wonder, and I'm also on connectors, I would stay away from, there's a company called Vanco, I believe, V-A-N-C-O. The companies are pushing them because they call them a two-piece, easy to put on end connector. They go on, the piece that goes on the cable, like on LMR 400 or 9913, which is what they're designed for, it threads on the jacket like a PL259. You solder a center pin that looks like a PL259. And then you put on a second piece which tightens down with a nut. And that piece, the pin that was soldered, goes into the other pin, which approximates an end connector. I've never swept them. I don't know what the characteristics are, but I got a gut feeling that sweeping them probably not good is a UG1. Maybe somebody has checked them out and found them to be good. I don't know. But to me, if it looks like a PL259 and smells like a PL259, it's 1296, it's probably going to work like one. So I would try to stay away from those. Dick, what I wanted to ask you, you know, I've been on 1296 sideband, 1232 sideband. I want to get into some 1296 FM DX, which I think very few people do. Right now I've got a tri-band vertical, 2 meters 440, 1.2. I have the D-Star FM radio on 1296, and I've got an ID800, 2 meter 440 FM D-Star going through a triplexer, which is lossy, going to the tri-band antenna. What I hope to do next summer, once I get over this illness, is to put up a separate 1296 antenna with AirCom Plus, just to it, with no triplexer. My question is twofold. I'd like to put a mass-mounted preamp up there, but I had an experience with a broadband preamp from SSD Electronics going to a R8500. The preamp, the antenna's very close. I'd order a tower. They're mounted on the back of the house within maybe 10 feet of each other. When I keyed up the rig on 2 meters with 100 watts, I blew the gas set in the broadband preamp. I wonder if this would be the same case with a tuned preamp on 1296, something made for outdoors at the tower. Jerry Rodsky at SSP has preamps that use Hemtests with 0.4 dB noise figure, worst case, and he puts a helical resonator ahead of them. How he gets 0.4 with a helical resonator ahead of a Hemtest, I have no idea, but I wonder if in your opinion that helical resonator is enough to keep 432 and 144 megahertz energy from blowing out the gas set. That's the first question. Also, as far as generating RF power, Barry N2MB had purchased from Death East Microwave a number of years ago, a 101 amplifier using four Mitsubishi modules. Those modules are no longer made, like $700. I'm hoping the technology to the point where you can generate for less than something like a 2C39. KTLIW, TechNet Limelock, M2EO.
Comes to the amplifiers that are Nestle Rich, you've got quite a few amplifiers, quite a few solid-state amplifiers that are coming out of the 900 meg service where they used to be used in pagers. There's also quite a few high-power amps coming out of 2 gig service. And if you go to the Microwave Reflect, you'll find quite a few of these amplifiers being converted by people these days in the 100-watt category. So solid-state high-power amps from 2 gigs down, they're getting quite popular, quite prevalent these days. So developing the power is not going to be difficult. When it comes to an antenna that's giving you a lot of gain on 1290, I would strongly recommend a Yagi, any of these antennas that are omnidirectional. It's with a good Yagi on 1296, you can, with not too much difficulty, develop 20 decibels of gain over ISO, whereas with a collinear type, you've got a devil of a dog of a problem getting beyond 12 dB, 14 dB. There's sort of a sound barrier there. And when it comes to the DXing you're going to be doing on 1296, it's going to be in specific directions. But for a man of your resources, put up both. Put up a good high-gain collinear on 1296 as well as a Yagi. When it comes to the low-noise preamp, and yes, you will get a little bit more performance at a low-noise preamp being at the antenna as a line driver. And in order to keep out-of-band frequencies out of it, the best approach is a real cavity filter. The helical resonator you're talking about might do it, but until somebody does a test where they find out how many dB is the rejection on 432 and 2 meters, and it's not too difficult a test to do. You could have somebody borrow or buy temporarily, so to speak, one of those preamps and literally sweep it on the right kind of a network analyzer and find out what is its amount of rejection of its front-end helical filter on those other frequencies. And if it's not 25 dB or more, I would worry about blowing the preamp. Another thing that happens with low noise preamps is that you're between a rock and a hard place, between filtering and noise figure. You can use the biggest cavity in the world, but the Q-loaded, Q-unloaded ratio is what determines the insertion. In other words, if the filter was very high in Q, and you load it to the point where it becomes very low in Q, the good news is you get very little insertion loss, and it has very little impact on the noise figure. The bad news is that when you load it heavily, it becomes broadband, and therefore a frequency out of band can get you. There's ways of testing this, as I see it, and once you do the test, you'll know ahead of time how much rejection. But even with a good preamp, even without a 432 or a 2-meter transmitter nearby, you're going to have to worry about lightning impulse. And the lightning, by the way, can get you not only through the antenna, but also through the feed line going to the antenna by all kinds of mysterious procedures. The good news about a 1296 Yagi is that it itself is a kind of a filter, which does a very good job of filtering out the 2 meters and the 432, whereas some of these collinear antennas, they are a hell of a lot more broadband. They get all kinds of spurious responses, and the chances of one of those picking up enough signal to blow the preamp is considerably higher. So test the preamp, put a Yagi on it, consider putting a damn good filter on the front end if you're not happy with the filtering of the preamp. And lots of guys have done that. Weatherproofing the filter, the great big cavity filter outdoors, requires a little bit of elbow grease, but it's the safe way to go. Back to you, Rich, for any comments on all of the above. N2EO, K2IW, the Tech Man.
Okay, just very good. Cavity would have quite a high Q and keep it. That's probably the best way to do it, because that preamp is over $300 from SSB. So, don't want to blow that gas set. Thank you very much, Dick. K2RIW, N2EO.
However, that preamp inside probably contains an MGF 1402 transistor. You go to the right guy, like WA5BJB, Whiskey Alpha 5, Victor Juliet Bravo, Mr. Kent Britton of Dallas, Texas, actually outside of Dallas, Texas. What's the name of it? Something Plains, High Plains, or something like Texas, where he lives. He's got MGF 1402s at a very nice price. When you blow the preamp transistor, the transistor in there itself is a $1 part. Replacing it, once you've got the right kind of a microscope, relatively easy to do. Yeah, you send it back to the SSB, and they're going to charge you $40 to change the transistor and retune it. You don't need to retune it. If the transistor that's in there is an MGF 1402, and you just simply put another one, you cut out the one that's there and solder another one on top, because they got these gold leads, and unsoldering is very difficult. Just cut it out and put another one on top. I've done that on these advanced receiver research preamps on probably 10 occasions. I simply replaced the preamp transistor. Occasionally I went and rechecked it, and I was wasting my time. As long as the MGF 1402 is alive, you come right back to the normal performance. So worry about that, Rich. You can yourself take that expensive preamp and fix it when you do blow it. So good luck with that project, and let us know how that goes. I think we've gone down the list of everyone who signed in with a question. Although maybe, Jesse, you had another one. I'll stand by and see if there's anyone else before we go over to our space section with Paul. Give your call letters right now, K2IW and the TechNet.
Okay,
if you're here,
Jack.
Okay, MWA recognized after Eric. Eric, go right ahead.
Yeah, just a point of information, like a Paul Neal connector. The best place to get information about how to put it together and what the dimensions are is amphenolrf.com. Amphenolrf.com. RF connectors, BNC, TNC, reverse TNC. Each connector that they sell has an assembly instruction on the...
Okay, so I think AmphenolRF.com has both the connectors and a lot of information. By the way, when it comes to these reverse polarity connectors, they can be a pain. In order to meet FCC rules, there are certain pieces of electronics that are manufactured with reverse polarity connectors to make sure that somebody doesn't make an inadvertent connection. But for we amateurs, I think they can be an awful pain, is reverse polarity connections. Maybe some of you guys like reverse polarity connections, but I'd like to have all my connectors the right sex. There's a pun there somewhere. Bob, KC2MWA, I think you want to make a comment. Go ahead.
Okay, Dick. Yeah, KC2MW. We're talking about cryo-fitting parts for airplanes. The F-14 used cryo-fit hydraulic connectors. They were trying to save weight in the airplane. Up to that point, everybody had pretty well used wage lock type fitting on all the hydraulic. The F-14, they would freeze one piece of tubing and slip it inside another piece. And then as the temperature changed, you had a good solid fluid tight connection.
That sounds awfully good. And by the way, earlier Rich was talking about the collet or the thimble that's inside of the braid to make sure that the connector is properly sandwiching and giving a good tight contact to the braid, as opposed to having the foam-filled cable snake itself down to a smaller diameter and become a great big weather seal leak. I'm strongly in favor of those kind of connectors, particularly when it comes to semi-rigid coax cable. The 75-ohm cable or 70-ohm cable that the CATV industry uses. There's cheap connectors, and there's really good connectors made by Anexapruzan, among other people, where there really is an inner collet that slips inside of the outer conductor aluminum jacket, and then the outer collet squeezes down on it, and you get a real good contact that doesn't vibrate itself loose. There have been cable systems installed in various towns throughout the United States where they use the cheap connectors, and when the cable on the telephone pole is waving back and forth in the wind for a couple of years, some of those connectors start becoming leaky, both RF-wise and weather-wise, and boy, that can be a pain. And that can be an extremely false economy situation to scrimp on the money that's spent on the connectors. I'm a big enthusiast, as Eric was saying earlier, of buying, and so is Doug saying, buy the right connector, install it correctly. Don't worry about the amount of time required to put on the connector properly for a piece of cable that's going to be used outdoors. Also, don't scrimp on the weatherproofing. You put a couple of drops of water inside of a type N connector, and you have just gained 10 decibels of loss. And I've made that measurement. And I'm also the foolish guy who said, hey, RIW parallel kilowatt amplifier, I can generate 700 watts. I'll simply boil the water away. No problem. And you key down the transmitter for 10 minutes, and you think you're going to boil away the water in the connector. And you do that procedure, and you go back to the listening mode, and everybody sounds very weak, and you wonder what's going on. You climb the tower, you take it apart, and you see a real mess in there of what you've done with high power and RF with water inside of a connector. The dissimilar metals, where you've got gold on the center conductor, and aluminum on the outside, or whatever, and water, and high power RF, and steam, it makes a mess. And you can't boil away the water with RF. You can dream about it, it's a dream, it doesn't happen. You've got to make sure the water doesn't get there in the first place, and if the water is there, you're going to go through the mechanical process of eliminating the water and do a good weatherproofing job otherwise. Water at UHF frequencies, VHF and UHF frequencies, it is the lossiest stuff in the world. And if you don't believe it, read Southworth, that's the microwave handbook written by Mr. Southworth, the guy who essentially invented waveguide. Back in the late 1938s, I think he was working at Bell Labs, he needed a good dummy lobe for waveguide. He used water. He took the trough, he took the piece of waveguide, put it into a great big trough of water at a very shallow angle, so that there's really a wedge of water inside the guide. Sent RF down the guide, the water absorbed the RF, none of it reflected back. Water is a beautiful dummy load at these frequencies. So if the water gets inside of your connector on 6 meters and above, you're gonna suffer. Keep it out of there. And one of the things that I like to do is to set up my antennas in such a way where the semiconductor of the cable is floating. The driven element of the Yagis are floating. Therefore, I can sit in the shack with an ohmmeter, I can measure from the semiconductor to the ground, and I'm measuring every one of the connectors in that phased array of the 16 Yagis all simultaneously. If every one of those connectors have no water, I'll see 10 megaohms. You start getting a little bit of water in one of those connectors, and you start coming down to 500 kOhms and below. And when you get a whole lot of water in more than one connector, you can come down to numbers like 20 and 30 kOhms. And all of a sudden you realize everybody you talk to is 10 dB weaker, and you know what's going on. The good news of having floating driven elements that are mounted with insulators on the boom is you can do the ohm meter test. The bad news is now the antenna is subject to lightning pickup, impulse, EMP, and so on. So unless you've got a very steady, very sturdy RF choke to ground that you put on in the shack at the semiconductor, or unless you've got a great big cavity filter somewhere, floating connectors on a antenna that's outdoors usually is a no-no. The static pickup will eventually give you some trouble if there isn't a very good RF choke to ground somewhere in the system. So there's pros and cons on that one. Okay, I think we ought to let Paul tell us what's going on with the space shuttle. Thank goodness they finally launched. I think they're getting out of the way in time for the Russian mission that's coming up afterwards. And I guess it was Eric today walking around listening to what the shuttle astronauts were saying live. Interesting stuff. Paul, let's see now. WS2N, KQLIW in the TechNet.
Yep.
Okay, good evening, Dick. I'm going to be on a different level now here. Okay. That was my computer. Power supply, something making noise there. That's all. I'll have to look into that. Dick. One thing I wanted to mention before we talked about the space shuttle, that suit sat that we talked about, the all-land Russian space suit that was pushed out the International Space Station a few months ago, has finally deorbited. It was supposed to deorbit like a month or two ago, but it's been floating around. They thought it was going to come down a long time ago. Finally came back. STS 115 finally got off the ground after a couple of weeks ago. They had the lightning strike, and then it was delayed again early in the week. It had the fuel cell problem. The fuel cell problem gave him a bit of a fit. There's motors inside, you know, that drives the pump. And they're three-phase motors. They don't use their single-phase DC motors. They use the actual AC three-phase motors. The question was put to Michael Griffin, the administrator of the HAM. He said they need the three-phase motors because if one phase fails, it'll keep running. DC, if it fails, you know, they're out of luck. But there's three fuel cells on board, each one of these fuel cells, like a big box, 4 feet long, roughly 14 inches wide, 14-inch, like 14-inch box, they weigh almost 300 pounds each. And there's three of them on board that supplies electricity on board. You drop it over and change power. And the fuel cells produce all the electricity for the shuttle. The problem with fuel cells is you use hydrogen and you use oxygen, and you wind up with water. One of the things that produces heat, they have to get rid of that heat. So there's a Freon loop inside the fuel cells to keep it cool. And when the spaceship is in orbit, they open up the cargo bays, and in the cargo bay doors they have aluminum piping, and that's where they radiate the heat. But when the shuttle doors are closed, sitting on the pad and coming back, they need some kind of a Freon cooling loop to move the heat anyway away from the box fuel cells.
and I guess they anticipate that later.
So they finally come to the conclusion after, what, 2 days, that, well, we're going to launch anyway. And they thought that would be very good. They get onto the launch pad on Friday and get ready to take off. I'm listening to it live. Sure enough, it was scrubbed. And it was a similar problem to what they had two missions ago when Eileen Collins, the woman commander from New York State, was on board STS-114. They had they call it an eco problem, an engine cutoff problem down in the hydrogen tank. Four sensors, four cutoff sensors. They're all for redundancy, really. While one of them was acting up, they defueled it. That cost us $600,000. And then they refueled it again, and when they refueled it again, everything was fine. So they finally did take off, and successfully yesterday, and it worked out quite well. Nice launch at 11:15. There was some debris that they noticed that came off. They have cameras mounted on the shuttle. After about 4 minutes, actually 4 minutes and 6 seconds, there was one little piece that came off. And this poses no problem to the shuttle. If it was earlier on, when you're in a heavy dense atmosphere, right, you might have a problem. You know, they'll give it some thought because the air is so dense that that piece accelerates, you know, relative to the shuttle and causes damage. When you're getting that high up, so you're going 4,000 miles an hour around that point when this little piece came off, you're officially almost in space, 60 miles up in space, and as they were close to it, the air is very rarefied at that point. And the piece tends to, you know, it will drop behind it, but it tends to do it not as quick as when you're down in the denser atmosphere. So that worked out okay. They did check, of course, when they got to orbit. They used the robotic arm. They want to test the robotic arm anyway. They're going to be using it quite a bit on this mission. And they have sensors now on the robotic arm, and they're able to check the leading wings on both sides of the spacecraft and pull over everywhere to make sure that there was no damage, which is the case. And they'll double check again when they get up to the International Space Station tomorrow morning at 6:45. They'll do a pirouette. They'll do a backflip at the space station. The crew has special cameras on board that was brought up on quite a few flights ago. I think actually was brought up by the Russian flight group probably about 2 years ago, getting ready for the future flights. And big cameras, they can take pictures of the shuttle. It does flip, and which they've done for the last two missions that Discovery went up. And they'll check it out. And then they'll dock with the spacecraft immediately. After that, they're going to, sounds like they're going to do this like right away. They're going to get this 17.5-ton piece of cargo out of the cargo bag, which is a P3 and P4 structure. At the end of that, you've got the gigantic solar panels that are going to unfurl 240 feet long. That should be quite interesting. It's going to take them, you know, between setting this thing up, they're going to take it out with a robotic arm and hand it over to the robotic arm on the International Space Station. Now there's two robotic arms up there, one on the space station and one in the shuttle. One's going to hand it to the other one. Operators on both sides of this. Three astronauts are on board the International Space Station at the time. They'll be operating that robotic arm. They fixed the mobile transport unit, essentially a little car, train-like gadget, which will ride along the whole structure. They now have a space station crane attached to that. Once it takes the hands off from the shuttle, that mobile transport unit will drive to the end and get ready to put this thing in place to make this whole truss structure that it's riding on even longer with the T3, T4 truss setup. 17.5 tons worth of it, and it's unbelievable. When you look at the pictures of it, you see somebody standing next to it when it's in when it's on the ground. It's quite a big piece of equipment they're putting up there. And this will involve three different spacewalks by two people spacewalk to complete this stuff, whole setup. They're not going to power it up. That will wait until CS-116 when that goes up. That's going to bring another truss structure up as well. No solar panel on that one. And they're going to have a couple of spacewalks involved with that. And at that time, they'll power up this solar panel that they're bringing up at this time. And that should be it. There's questions about will it be off balance a little bit? Will gyros hold up? Will they use thrust of power from the shuttle that necessarily, you don't want to use the shuttle thrusters. A lot of things are going to come into question. They said it all looks good on paper, but see what happens when we bulb it all up. So that's pretty much it for now, Dick. Any questions? I'll be here. This is WX2X.
Very nice, Paul. The 17 tons of hardware, that's 35,000 pounds being brought up. That's a lot of mass. That's 10 automobiles being brought up there. Wow. And one of the things I don't hear a lot about, and here's my first question. I've got two. And that is, what goes up must come down. More and more hardware in the International Space Station is being put up. And I guess we had an original predicted life of X number of years, and of course we're going to go to X plus some other number of years that we're really going to use the space station. But at some time, the space station will have served its purpose, and in theory, you can't afford to keep going up there with boosters to keep boosting it to a higher orbit, because it's always slowly experiencing a little bit of drag and slowly coming down to a lower orbit. So all of this hardware is going to come back to us someday. Has anyone ever talked about how you safely deorbit the biggest thing that has ever been put into space? Back to you, Paul.
I've heard two proposals. First of all, this thing's not coming down for a real long time. Predicted lifespan is supposed to be 15 to 20 years for the International Space Station. It's not going to be built until 2010. So, figure 2020 is minimum. That would be a 10-year run if they decided to abandon it. So I guess by 2020, 2025, they'll think about it a little bit more at that time. I've heard theories that they would try to disconnect it from a couple of spacewalks. There are thrusters on board. You could actually control the orbit somewhat. Similar to what they did with Mir, that whole thing came down in one shot. Mir was what, about 25% of the size that this thing is now. Control and crash into the Pacific is what they would probably do. I don't think it's going to happen for a very long time. And even in the future, you're going to have the crew exploration vehicle going up. Now called the Orion Project. Besides that, I mean, when they go up, they're going to be sitting on one of these solid booster rockets that are made by a Morton Viacom, and then on top of that, they'll have a hydrogen oxygen type of rocket, for a crew exploration vehicle. But essentially, they'll be put up mainly with a solid booster rocket. People think, well, that's it, no more heavy equipment. They're designing a cargo launch vehicle, which is an external tank, which is very similar to the external tank, those big orange tanks that they use now on the space shuttle. And attached to it, they're going to attach two of these gigantic solid boosted rocket that they use today. And on top of it, on top of that tank, they'll have the payload, whatever it might be. It might be, you know, 17 and a half tons. They say they'll be able to launch equal to or more than what Apollo used to launch. You might be able to launch, who knows what. I don't even know what the weight capability is, but a lot. So if you want to build more space stations or add to this one, or maybe even send an empty one up and put a couple of pieces into the cargo facility in the year 2025 and deorbit it, maybe put it into the ocean that way there. That could be a possibility too. A lot of possibilities. But this thing is it's new. Even so, they started launching pieces up in what, year 2000. This thing is, it's not even built yet. And then you got 15-20 year lifetime after that. Back to you there.
Okay. My next question is reference to the Hubble Space Telescope. I caught a news report, I think was on CBS television about a week ago, in which Michael Griffin was being interviewed. They showed I think it was Boeing Aerospace, but I'm not sure. But anyhow, one of the major aerospace companies is constructing a Hubble Space Telescope mock-up so that the astronauts can begin practicing on the next repair mission. So at least in the talking phase, I'm hearing that Hubble is going to be saved. Are you hearing any words along these lines, Paul?
About a month ago or so, Michael Griffin made a comment to somebody. You know, I heard it as a report. This guy was reporting that he was thinking about it, talking about it. At that time, let's say a month or two ago, they were still at that point discussing it, so it wasn't a dead issue. And I got my fingers crossed. I see already they're starting to, you know, loosen things up a little bit. The space shuttle is going to take off in daytime, 100% daytime. That's it. Listening to the mission director. I forget his name. He was on, and he said, well, we might launch this mission, one that just went up at night in October, early October, instead of waiting until the end. And the question was, you know, I thought this was going to be daytime only. He said, well, no, that's, you know, they said it's definitely the first two flights. They were get ready test flights. So he said, after that, they would say, well, we have to launch at night, we can. That's not what I heard at the beginning. But he said this was the way it was laid out. And he said, well, it was his decision that at least this flight would also go up in the daytime. But they might change that if this thing was delayed anymore. You know, they're trying to launch another 15 missions before 2010. And yeah, you're right, the Russian Soyuz is going to go up right after the international, right after the space shuttle leaves, when Atlantis leaves, they'll have another craft go up like a day or two later and dock with the space station. And by the way, on that flight they have another paying passenger, this woman is going up. She was a backup, a guy that was supposed to be going up. He couldn't make it or whatever, so she's going up. She's going to spend like 10 days on the space station. And then come back. So, I wanted to bring that up. I know you mentioned that at the beginning. Take it back to you.
Yeah, run that by again. If I understand correctly, the paying passenger, civilian, is that on the Russian launch that's going to take place very soon?
Right after the space station is free, you know, Atlantis is going to leave and this thing's going to go up. They don't want to have everybody up there at one time. They call it a traffic jam. We go into Washington News, but they definitely don't want Soyuz up there and a space shuttle at the same time. So that's why this thing was going to be delayed till October. They didn't want to stop this Russian flight from going up. So if it didn't make it off the ground Saturday, yesterday, this thing was going to get pushed back maybe till the end of October, like the third week, because the Russian flight is scheduled to go up, and then by the time they come down, the space station would have been free again for Atlantis to go up. So, yeah, that's the way it works.
Okay, you could use a little bit more audio, and there's a little bit of hiss in your background, but we're still hearing you quite well, Paul. I think rendezvous between Space Shuttle STS-115 and the International Space Station, that rendezvous takes place, I believe, tomorrow morning, and then within a small number of hours after that, after they do the flip over and an inspection, and if all that goes well, I presume the deployment of the 17.5-ton module takes place real soon. And based on the success of the last two International Space Shuttle rendezvous with Space Station, with the shuttle, I believe some of the rules will become relaxed a little bit, and I'd like to believe some nighttime launches will take place, and we'll start some stronger talk about repairing Hubble before Hubble gets into any serious damage. Is that approximately the scene the way you see it, Paul? Go ahead.
QS Delta, that's a good layout of what they're doing. I think the Hubble's going to be saved. They're definitely going to give that a shot. Even so, they have all these other space telescopes up there. You know, they got the Spitzer telescope, they got that WMAP, and I don't know if that's still operating or not. The Galax is another one. They've got all kinds of space telescopes up there. You've got the Chandra space telescope. Each one seeing in different wavelengths. But, you know, you can't beat the Hubble. And then the replacement of it, I don't know, I heard they're either going to take that off the table, the James Webb telescope, or delay it, or I don't know, that's got all kinds of funding problems. And you won't see that thing up until another, I don't know, maybe 10 years. So they'd like to get this thing running and keep it going for at least another 3 or 4 years, if not longer. Back to you, Dick.
Yeah, there's a lot of Hubble huggers out there that really want that one to go. Chandra does a beautiful job of taking X-ray pictures. To my knowledge, the Wilkinson anisotropy probe, WMAP, it is still operational. It's completed its main mission, and it did measure a small number of microkelvins of delta temperature of black-body radiation in space, therefore mapped the whole universe with ridiculously high accuracy. A lot higher accuracy than the previous one, whose name I can't think of right now. Okay, good stuff. We did have today a rather nice hamvention, flea market, whatever. Couldn't complain about the weather. No rain, blue sky, not too hot, not too cold. Just about the right number of vendors, just about the right number of buyers. A little bit of money flowed. I bought everything I saw that I wanted. Nobody was fighting me for it. So I had a good time at the flea market. Anyone else want to tell us their impression of what took place at Briarcliff College today? Give me a call letters right now, and we'll put you on the list for describing what you saw, what you liked, and what do you think maybe should be changed. K2RIW and the TechNet.
And so we owe Dick.
Rich recognized. Anyone else? Okay. If you tell me you were at the flea market today, Rich, I'm going to be a little bit surprised. N2EO, go right ahead.
No, I wasn't there, Dick, but I want to thank Kayvon W2KTU and Howard W2HWW. They got me a very good deal on a Motorola 10-meter handy talkie. It's a Radius D200. It's got to be programmed up. It's a six-channel unit, and there's only six channels available on 10 meters. So I just want to say thank you very much.
until we get
fantastic. Yeah, I'm hearing stronger and stronger reports from Howie, among other people, that you get some extremely long range out of a 10 meter repeater. And so it seems like we all jumped on 2 meters as the right frequency for repeaters, but 10 meters has got a lot going for it. And where you might have a range of, say, reliable range of 30 miles or so from a repeater to a 2 meter mobile, you can have something close to twice that distance of range when you're building a good 10-meter repeater and talking to a 10-meter mobile. So the 10-meter band has the frequency spectrum available. No one's complaining about being too crowded, particularly during a low part in the sunspot, a low period in the sunspot cycle. And so 10-meter repeaters and 900-meg repeaters, it's time we have them. And looks like people are working in that direction. Sounds like you're going to be happy. That handy talkie, too bad it's not one of these kind with thumbwheel switches you can easily program. Roughly, what is the size of it compared to, say, an IC2AT? Rich, go ahead.
A little bigger. I would say, if you're familiar with my 12TAT, which is 1296 handy talkie, it's about the same size. It's part of the radius line of Motorola HCs. Very, very nicely built. Got it with the charger. Brand new in the box. I just want to say thank you very much to Kayvon and Howard. We discussed this the other night, and they picked it up for me, and it's just got to be programmed up now, but came with a battery, full charged up and ready to go. Like I say, Dick, it's about the size of a 12GAT, which is the same size approximately as an 04 or an 02GAT.
Very nice. Now, this is a 10-meter handy-talkie, or it's a rig that covers 10 meters. Was it originally intended for 31 megacycle service or something like that, Rich Grant?
My understanding is they have three versions of that radio. The low, this one officially covers 30 to, I believe it's 36 megs. And then they've got other models that cover higher ends up towards the 50 megahertz range. You need the one that goes down to 30. Officially, Motorola says it goes to 30, but it will make 29, the frequencies on 29.5, 29.6. These are no longer in production. This is what I'm...
So it's no longer in production. Did it go out of production fairly recently, Rich? And maybe Rich has got to change his battery. Okay. Anyone else want to discuss any of the above or a new subject? Has anyone heard from Mel, K2KEY, and have any words as to how Mel is doing? I'm mildly concerned that I haven't heard him on tonight and did not see him at the flea market today, and I expected to. K2LIW listening.
I had one question, Dick, WS2N.
Paul recognized. Did I hear another station in there? Okay, go ahead with your question, Paul. WS2N, you got the floor.
Okay, Dick. I have my power level, by the way, okay?
Beautiful. You sound great.
I moved the antenna. For some reason, it was interfering with the... heard this buzz that sounded like it was coming out of the power supply in the computer. I don't know. Very strange. Question, oscilloscope question, Dick. Although I'm an extra, when it comes to oscilloscope, I'm a novice. So I'm trying to operate this thing. I've got a book on it. It's a Heath kit, an old Heath kit oscilloscope. And the model 0-8.